Vodka o'clock.
It's Vodka O'Clock, and I'm Amber Love of AmberUnmasked.com. Just a reminder, we are labeled as an explicit podcast and website. Joining me today is Richard Clark, one of my artist friends that I've invited on to talk about the life of an artist, figure drawing, painting, art news, and all sorts of whatever else comes up. So, Rich, welcome to Vodka O'Clock.
Well, thank you, Amber, Amber Love, Amber Loves Comics, Amber Unmasked. Holy smokes, you've got a lot of AKAs.
I do. I know. That's only like part of it.
That's only part of it?
That's when you're not throwing the Elizabeth in the front.
Oh, no. It gets even deeper?
It gets unruly. It just gets incredibly unruly. Well, here's the thing. See, there's an Amber Love who is much more involved in the porn industry.
Uh-oh.
And there's an Elizabeth Amber who is a very successful romance novelist.
Oh.
So if when I start tacking on all of the names to become like the unique identifier, it goes really berserk. I'm like, you know, like handles don't allow that many characters. So whenever a new social media comes up, I have to try to get the name first.
Well, try being Richard Clark.
Yeah. How about that, Dick Clark?
Yeah, Dick Clark. There was a Richard Clark with the same spelling doing some stuff back, God, nearly 20 years ago now when I was doing the White Wolf thing. And there was a Richard Clark E with doing the same genre and brand of stuff. And then we all remember Bill Clinton's former, wasn't Homeland Security at the time. It was whatever Defense Department offshoot that he was a part of that George Bush jettisoned shortly after 9/11. And Richard Clark is rather ubiquitous. So I try to separate it out by saying I'm Richard P., as in Paul Clark.
Yeah, well, that makes you sound like, you know, a cultist.
Yeah, me and David Koresh. Yeah, either that or a serial killer.
Yeah, no, well, that's when you start using the three names, the three name thing. I must sound like a female serial killer.
Nice.
But yeah, they always do the three name thing.
You would be the first. Female serial killers are not too common.
No, not really.
No. So what's going on, lady?
So let's get to know you. Because I know you. Other people might know you, but other than, you know, me being able to say you're this incredible artist, and now I've just learned chess player. I just think that it's nice to talk to interesting people. So I wanted to, you know, we're gonna pull out all the stops here. We're gonna get all Barbara Walters on your ass, and you know, make you cry. Tell me about your childhood.
Okay. Well, first things first. Let's start at the beginning. You said you want to speak to interesting people, so pardon me while I go find someone for you, because I certainly do not think I quite qualify as that. However. My childhood, let's see.
What's your background? Like, well,
I was born and raised in the Cleveland, Ohio area.
Yes, the land of Cleves. We've heard of that.
Mm-hmm, the land of Cleves, as in Mateen Cleves. But I digress. I grew up in suburban Cleveland, went to a suburban Cleveland school, and started drawing pretty much as soon as I could hold a pencil. Interest in, you know, making visual art and superhero stuff specifically, pretty much right out of the box. A very funny story is my mom likes to tell from time to time. In kindergarten, I did a drawing of the kitchen table with my mom and dad standing on one side, yelling, my dad's arm reaching across, all the way across the table and giving a smack to my little sister, who was also crying. And then I was standing on the kitchen table in a Superman costume with my arms raised like, look at me, I'm Superman. So, from the earliest, I've been a narrative visual art maker.
I think that makes sense. Before we called it cosplay, and we called it playing pretend.
Yeah, well, and to that end, actually, though I don't certainly do the cosplay type stuff to the level that you and your fellows do, you know, my level of cosplay begins and ends at wearing a sport coat and a nice shirt at conventions. My mom, when I was a tiny little kid, made me a Batman cape and made me a Superman cape that I used to run around the house in. So, yeah, visual art and comic books and superheroes in particular from the earliest age were a big interest of mine.
Let's jump ahead to, like, the high school era.
Oh, that's a good thing that we're jumping ahead there, because that means I can skip over where I was kicked out of Catholic school in eighth grade.
Oh, well, see, now you make me want to go back.
Nope, too late. You know, we fast-forwarded, and that's all to the good. In high school, I was very, very interested still in visual art. I was still reading and collecting comics. I started collecting in earnest probably at about age 7 or 8. One of my earliest big comic book scores at a Cleveland convention, my dad bought me Tales to Astonish number 102. And for, the real archivists, they'll know that that was when The Incredible Hulk came over to Tales to Astonish. And even way back when, the mid-70s, that was a fairly collectible book, so it was a big-time treasure. But, you know, I was there through all the Byrne Claremont X-Men and, totally into Wolverine and all of the cool X characters. And I started buying the X books shortly after 137, they were still new enough that I didn't have to go deep into my pockets or trade, you know, crazy amounts of current comics with friends to pick up, you know, all the really important Byrne Claremont X-Men. So I got to see the Phoenix Saga and all that good stuff in first run. And that carried into high school. 15, 16, girls started becoming far more important than funny books. So interest in that waned, but interest in drawing, because at this point I still had not made an acquaintance with the paintbrush. Interest in girls kind of supplanted comics, but they kept coming and going and coming and going. And then 1986 happened. Does anyone remember 1986?
I was very heavily into the Stevie Nicks and Madonna of 1986.
Well, at the same time that was going on, 1986, let me regale you with tales of what 1986 brought us. It started a little bit in 1985, but the middle to tail end of 1985, Frank Miller's Ronin hit the mainstream. Still one of, in my opinion, one of the, you know, big high water marks and really, really important, like capital A art comics to ever be printed in the United States. And shortly after that, a fellow by the name of David Mazzucchelli was just starting to come into his own on a title called Daredevil. Frank Miller came back to Marvel to write Daredevil Born Again. At the same time, he was writing Elektra Assassin for Bill Sienkiewicz to paint.
That was some sort of like a renaissance there.
At the same time, God bless Archie Goodwin, and, you know, rest in peace, and thank God for, you know, his, you know, for everything that he did for his legacy. At the same time, a fellow by the name of John J. Muth and another fellow, contemporary of his and friend, name of Kent Williams, hit on two books written by Mark DeMattis, Moonshadow and Blood, respectively. Those came out at that time. So 1986, you know, I'm like, kicking around some of my comics and, you know, some of the subscriptions were still coming in and all this and all that. One of the books I had subscribed to was Daredevil, and then it got really good again. So I go to the comic book shop, and I mean, an epiphany. These books just rose to the fore. It was unlike anything I had imagined, and, you know, being a rube from suburban Cleveland, I called them fine art comics.
Sure. Well, and we're going to get into that, about what the labels in art, you know, perhaps indicate to people. But I want to stick with young Richard Clark for a moment.
Okay. Well, 86, since it was happening in the comic industry, you know, I had been very familiar with Bill Sienkiewicz. I think his run on Moon Knight, his run on Moon Knight was epic. Hit Me, the final issue that he did before Kevin Nolan landed in comics. That issue Hit Me.
Why?
1984-5-ish. It changed the game for me. That was the beginning of the realization that, oh my goodness, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, the Marvel House style in order for it to be really impactful and gorgeous and beautifully drawn and really deep. And, you know, we can look back on it now, you know, me in my 40s, and say, well, you know, that was, this is what was happening symbolically. You know, there was an allegory with the music. There was a rhythm tied into it. All this sort of stuff, and we can quantify it now. But as an adolescent, all I saw was something bigger and things that were being discussed in, you know, honors English classes and things like that, tying into a kind of art to which I hadn't been exposed. So my love of comics was rekindled, not for the first time. I liken my forays into the comic industry, this is adult language, so we can be a little grown up. I liken it to my dalliances with pot back in the day. I would not have, for a long time I was a pretty active social drinker, so it's very ironic that I would be on a podcast called Vodka O'Clock. And yes, this love affair with alcohol began while I was at this period of time that I'm describing in high school.
That's not uncommon.
No.
Experimenting starts.
And in suburban Cleveland, it is really not uncommon.
And it's really cold up there, so you need to keep warm.
Keep warm and keep entertained, because if any place in the United States could be a poster child for suburban ennui and the plight of, you know, bored suburban kids, Cleveland in the middle 80s certainly qualifies as a poster child for that. But
right. I mean, all I think about that, it's like, because I've never been to Cleveland, so all I can think of is the Drew Carey show.
Well,
maybe that's everything. Like, to me, it's like there's nothing else of Cleveland for those kind of people and those kind of houses. And it's, you know, and of course that's anywhere. I mean, literally, you could pick that up and plop that into any given town.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just so funny that that's all that, like, that's my knowledge of the Cleveland.
Well, you certainly, being a Jersey girl, you certainly got the longer end of the stick, in terms of regions that get, you know, to be the butt of a lot of national jokes, because, I mean, you know,
unflattering shows about New Jersey.
there are unflattering shows about New Jersey, but at the same time, there are also, you know, dramatic, romantic odes to New Jersey, like The Sopranos.
Sopranos, of course. People think that's what it's like.
Well, for some very wealthy mobsters, maybe it is.
It makes for great novels and, you know, great television, I suppose, and it makes for some less than great television, you know, but...
Jersey Shore. Jersey Shore.
Yeah. So...
Yeah, and, you know, if anything, maybe that should point the national consciousness a little more in favor of Cleveland. I mean, sure, you know, we may have been the mistake by the lake, but New Jersey gave us Snooki, so you guys still owe us big.
She came from New York.
Uh-huh, mm-hmm. What was the name of the show on which she became part of the pop culture consciousness?
Yes, well, somebody paid her tolls to get here.
Oofa.
Yeah. Now, during all of this growing up in Cleveland and getting high and experimenting with the vodka and stuff, so were you an only child or did you have influences here?
No. As I said, I had a younger sister who was caricatured, even though I didn't know it was a caricature at the time. That would come later. I had a younger sister who was caricatured, as I said, you know, back in kindergarten. And I had an uncle, my mom's youngest sibling, who was only a year and a half older than me. And he and I grew up very, very much like brothers did. And as far as the getting high thing goes, I never finished my joke on that. My dalliances with comics was much like my, occasional foray into pot smoking. I would try it once every 5 years, remember why I didn't like it, and then, stay away from it for a while. So,
yeah, and then you want to try something new. Maybe there's something to check out, or maybe it's not as bad anymore.
Yeah. And then I would try it, and then, it's not something I like. And, I'm in the middle of another one of my 5-year cycles, it seems, doing an awful lot of comic book work.
was the family supportive of?
Hugely.
Of art? Okay. Because
usually.
Sometimes it can be, and other times family's not. Either they're simply not there, or they're just like, no, you are never going to ever make a living at this. They don't make money. You know, go study accounting, or go be a dentist, and, you know. Then writers go through the same thing. Cause, mm-hmm. It's always great and comforting to hear when families are supportive of, you know, somebody pursuing an art career.
Well, they were as supportive as they could be, as they knew how. I can't go and, say that because I had support that it was an idyllic upbringing. It's the 70s and 80s was the time of 50% divorce rates. And, I certainly fell within that average. My folks split up and, my dad stuck around. It was almost never a time in my life where my dad wasn't part of the equation, which was very great for both me and my sister. But, we had this pretty much the same place to live. From the time when I think I was a year and a half until 17, when my folks got back together and built a house even further out into the suburbs. Even as much as the family wasn't, mom and dad together, they still strove to make sure that I could do the visual art thing, which, as you say, especially in a very, very blue-collar environment, is not the norm. The prevailing wisdom usually is, go into the trades, I have carpenters and beauticians, and that's it, in the whole family tree. I mean, carpenters who went on to be foremen and supervisors and, win architectural awards and all that other stuff. But still, construction and cosmetology were the two industries in the family. So it was a big, big, big leap of faith for them to encourage, as fervently as they did, a kid who just wanted to draw and drink.
So, all right. So now we've, so you have a family that's not, telling you that art is dumb or a waste of time. So in the Cleveland area there, did you go to an art college or an art school, or did you travel away, or did you just go the traditional route and just continue learning on your own?
Well, I did do quite a bit of learning on my own. Got some books and supplies and things of that sort, and had some real, rube ideas about what art should be. Oh, you can't copy a picture. Goodness, that's cheating. That's awful. And, actually stunted my growth, not being aware that, even 15th and 16th century Renaissance masters learned their trade by having, tomes. I mean, very large books full of anatomical idealized figures from which they were supposed to make faithful copies in order to grasp the idea of form and line and movement and rendering and blah, 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 blah.
And so, I think that's really important because, I was too scared to go to art school, and it's because I didn't know those things. I didn't know that people work up to it. I just thought that people were, oh, my God, that good. I was literally scared. I'm like, I went on the interview, and I'm just like, this is terrifying. These people are amazing. I suck. I want to draw cartoons with, the bubbly hands and feet and, silly noses and stuff. I'm like, there's no way, absolutely no way I could possibly do this. So, the fact that you had some sort of idea already of the process that it takes is, it's magnificent. I would look at art books and I'm just like, I didn't know how Da Vinci got that good. I just figured he was that good. What else do you do when there's no television?
Well, there is some of that, yes. Pull some of our better geniuses, out of contemporary time and plop them into the middle of, 15th century Florence, and things would have been different because the distractions would have been fewer and all that other stuff. But, at the same time, thank God for, representative democracy, because I certainly didn't have a connected family and politically or religiously connected family, and I don't think I would have fared well pursuing an art ambition in that environment. But again, I digress. The awareness of that process actually came later.
But did you go to an art school?
Yes. I went to, regular old public school, and there was an art class there. And, one of the many ironies of my life, I managed to do really, really, really well sophomore and junior years with the same art teacher. But freshman year didn't do as well, despite the fact that the work was the same and the same quality. And my senior year, she was such a hag that I managed to fail art.
Wow. That's one of those stories that, it's inspiring to hear about failing. In fact, one of the other artists that I work with, Carolyn Bilevsky, she does graphic design work too, and she put out on Twitter, she's like, someone just told me, and I don't know how to respond to this, you have a lot of really good ideas, and you have a lot of really bad ideas. What do I say? So I just said, well, you tell them, the cliche, whatever, I don't know exactly, but it's something like, Edison discovered 1,000 ways not to invent a light bulb, too.
10,000, actually.
So there you go. That's what it is. And she loved that. So It's awful to say that it's great hearing about people's failures.
Well, it isn't awful. It's I agree with you. I find that downright encouraging. Because even the undefeated 1972 Miami Dolphins, they didn't lose a game, but they didn't hold every opponent scoreless. Some of those games came right down to the wire. They weren't some impressive otherworldly juggernaut. They just they just happened to win every game and then managed to finish it up with the Super Bowl victory. It's again, that wasn't a scoreless game. That wasn't a game that was, entirely, dominated soup to nuts, top to bottom. And even in every victory, there is some learning that takes place, and learning comes from making mistakes.
So what did you learn about dealing with people, at this point? Because a teacher is somebody who, has so much power over your life.
Well,
I mean, they control whether, whether you pass, fail, whether you move forward a grade or not. And I know they don't do that now, but, it was a different time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also, these parental units because they're with you for so many hours a day. So besides learning to, hey, I got to pick up my speed here with art, did you learn something about people?
Well, the lesson, failing art, was entirely about people. 100%. As it turns out, this art teacher of mine had her own issues, and I won't go into all of them specifically, because she's not here to rebut, and that's unfair, but she had her own stuff going on. And while I might not have been able to articulate it at age 18 as well as I can now, 25 years later, there was an awareness that, some of this isn't about me. Some of this is about her being a hag. And at the same time that was going on, there were Saturday courses that my folks would enroll me in periodically at the Cleveland Institute of Art, college where another really prominent comic book guy named Brian Michael Bendis actually went and got a degree in painting, I think it was.
You might have heard of him.
Yeah. The name rings out, right? I would go to Saturday courses there that were taught by the undergrads who were, though I didn't know this until many years later, just working off some, college tuition. But, to my, very youthful and still very burgeoning awareness, these were, oh my God, type, draftsmen and, painters. And, they could draw. They'd look at it and make a representation of it, in two dimensions. And wow, that was just, very impressive. So, it was inspiring and made me work harder. And I did well in those things. So I knew if I was doing okay over here, and I've got this wicked, twisted, sea hag of a person over here with enormous psychological issues, giving me static that more had to do with our personal interaction, maybe the art part is not the problem. So it was an early lesson in subjectivity.
Sure. And, perhaps helped you deal with editors later on in life.
Well, I don't know. Currently my experience with editors, get out the butt smooching sound effects. I'm about to get servile here. Currently in the last 10 years, my experience with editors in editorial comics has been universally wonderful.
That's great, because I mean, when I think about, you know, when there's always fan uproar about the big huge titles and stories that go on, a lot of the excuse comes down is, well, you guys don't understand editorial. Like, you know, I was told to guide the characters in this way. They let me write the book, but this is, you know, this all comes down the pipe. You know, it's you know, not a democracy there. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know at our, you know, my ranks of anyway of like indie comics, it's totally different. Like, you know, the editorial process for indie is completely different. Like, we don't have legacies to deal with and preserve and worry about, you know, pleasing so, you know, millions of fans. It's just not going to happen.
Or $100 million chunks of IP that are owned by enormous corporations that answer to shareholders.
Exactly. So it's a very different ballgame. But that's, you know, I know editorial, not necessarily editors, but editorial as a process gets blamed for so much.
No, I don't play in that arena. You know, I've done some, you know, I did some Marvel work back in the day. I just did an assignment with Derek Robertson for DC last year on Batman Arkham Unhinged. I also did a bunch of, I think I painted 30 trading cards for the Upper Deck. Was it Upper Deck or Freer? I forget. But, you know, the Versus trading card game. I think I painted 30 of those a few years back. And, you know, each and every time I've had some experience with editorial, or in the case of the trading card job, you know, licensing, every single person has just been terrific. And, you know, from the book standpoint, I don't know as much, because I do understand that there is, you know, having my experience being what it is in the outside world, you know, illustration, advertising, design, etc. I understand that there is much bigger stakes than just, you know, even as recently as 15 years ago. You know, now they're answering to really, really, really powerful money interests. And it's not a time where Frank Miller can come in and just retool Daredevil from the beginning.
I think that's sort of a misconception when people think they're going to break into comics, is that they're going to sort of be that level. Like, you're not going to break in and just become Mark Waid. That's not going to happen. You're not going to just break in and be Scott Snyder. It's, you know, these people have had careers.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's kind of it's a cool thing. I mean, it's sometimes it's a really funny thing. Like when people who have been doing their own less known comics for so many years, and all of a sudden they start getting nominated for awards like Best Newcomer, that always cracks me up.
I was, as you were saying it, I was thinking the same exact thing. And my favorite example is Chris Samney. You know, Samnee.
Yeah, he's just kicking it. Everybody's loving his work now because they know who he is. I've just kind of been following him from blogs and stuff.
So. Yeah, and you know, I remember listening to an interview with him probably 3 years now at this point, 3 years ago now at this point. He was up for a Best Newcomer Award, you know, 10 years in the business. So,
right,
but it's newcomer because, you know, it's newcomer to the you know, the big mass media pop culture part of this niche industry.
Yeah, I certainly would. It's an award. I'd be proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about how, because you know, we've gotten to a little bit about the process of studying with art and fine art. How do you make a distinction, or do you even make any kind of distinction between comic book art and fine art?
Well, I sure hope we've got an awful lot of tape slash hard drive space, because this is one of my favorite things to blather on and on and on about.
All right, well, we'll try to get the condensed version. Because one of the things that I... did you watch Buffy? Did you ever watch Buffy?
I saw the movie when it was in first run in theaters. That tells you how old I am.
Okay, well, that's totally different than the show. Because there is an episode when Buffy and the gang finally go off to college, and this vampire group is there, you know, kind of just living off of the newbies of the campus. They just pick off college freshmen. And it's a pretty funny episode. And the vampires start taking bets as to which quasi-tacky, predictable lithograph the freshmen will have in their bedroom, in their dorm room. So I'm thinking it's like, you know, it's always like a Gustav Klimt or something, you know, and I forget what the other artist choice was, but that they would take bets on. So I was thinking, and today, you know, that we're recording this, not when it comes out, obviously, but today when we're recording this is the anniversary of Jack Kirby's death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you put a poster of Spider-Man up on a wall, or, you know, Captain America or whoever, when you put something like that up on the wall, it's different than when you put up a poster of, you know, that came from Da Vinci or somebody. So, you know.
It is and it isn't. It is and it isn't. And, you know, the reason I say this is one of my favorite discussions to have is that, you know, when I was done with high school, I went to Ohio University for a year and a quarter, decided and found out I was not going to get the kind of education I felt I needed, and transferred to the Columbus College of Art and Design. That was a very professional-minded school. Teach hardcore skills, teach crazy, crazy, crazy ability to work past the point of exhaustion, pull all-nighters, you know, and still maintain a high level of craftsmanship and, you know, polished finish to what you're doing. All in the name of preparing young people for the real world of professional art making, which is bananas from a time management standpoint. So while I was there, I fell in love with the fine art department. Always knew I was going to make visual art professionally. You know, it's that I had the naivete of someone who just didn't think that, you know, there was any way that was not going to happen. maniac that I was.
That's really impressive, though, to actually have some sort of idea what you've wanted to do, because I've changed careers like 16 times.
Well, it's impressive much in the same way as all those lemmings who are committed to jumping off the ledge at the same time is impressive, I guess.
You just weren't going to look back.
Yeah, you know, hey, I've got a trajectory, I've got a path, I know where I'm going. Oh, shit, I'm going off a cliff. But that's a separate discussion. While I was there, I fell in love with the fine art department because, in my observation of what was going on there, they were not only teaching the best skills, mechanical skills, for making visual art, you know, drawing from observation, fidelity to subject matter, an awareness of when you were parting company with observed subject matter and idealizing it, how to build a surface, you know, prior to transferring over to CCAD, I had never used paint. I was 20 when I first picked up paint and, you know, real paint with a brush and all that. And I overwhelmed immediately because, you know, and it keeps coming back full circle. And some of the illustration teachers I had there who were more fine art oriented, you know, I would keep talking about blood. At the time, blood was, you know, Kent Williams' book, you know, JMD and Kent's book was, for me, that was it. That was, you know, I want to paint like this. I want to paint narrative art like this. I want to paint sequential narrative like this. This is what I wanted to do. And I would discuss fine art comics and, you know, get a little bit of a chuckle. And then a couple more years in, I found out that there is this enormous schism between, and this is, you know, the labeling system. I don't call it this, but this is the labeling system that exists. High and low art.
Right. And it makes it sound really base and crass, like low brow, as opposed to, you know, something better that adds to society.
Mm-hmm. And I chafed at that labeling system. I still do to this day. You know, I understand that there is a difference between original source art and applied art. You know, there's no doubt that there's a difference in that. You know, a genius like Picasso who will come along and cobble together a vast array of, you know, myriad influences and generate something new, you know, that's its own thing. And Guernica is one of the high water marks for Western culture in terms of painting and visual art. But, you know, now there are prints, as you point out, of things like Guernica, or one of my biggest heroes of all time, John Singer Sargent.
Oh, yeah. He's studied in every class that I work in.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, he's a superhero. He defined what modern portraiture is, and, you know, if for nothing else, that alone would make him part of the canon. But for sheer observational, you know, just mastery and courageous application of paint, and, you know, developing an approach to watercolor, which is what most people know him for, which I find to be a shame, but defining a system for watercolor that became, you know, the accepted, you know, watercolor is this, really started with him doing his very rapid studies. Those things alone would make him part of the canon, but, you know, just going and looking at his originals, going to the Met and standing in front of Madame X, or standing in front of Lady Macbeth, oh, you know, and that is where the hoity-toity intelligentista, you know, keepers of the fine art label start to get all uppity.
Well, what's interesting is because there's no difference in mastery of somebody who can paint that, you know, at that particular, like we're saying, godlike level, and the Frazettas of our world. It's like, just because you slapped wings on it doesn't make it not art.
No, but no, you just touched on a subject that's going to get me ostracized, so we should switch from Frazetta to somebody else, because I'll get beat up.
Oh, no.
I'm not a big Frazetta fan. Not a huge Frazetta fan, which makes me very, very unusual. However, it's my understanding through mutual friends that Jay Muth is not a Frazetta fan either, so I take some solace in knowing I'm not the only one.
That's okay. I always feel like I have to, like that I don't fit in even with my friends, because I'm like, well, I don't like Doctor Who and Game of Thrones either. So
you don't like Game of Thrones?
I know.
What?
I know.
Oh no! Oh no! We've got to go full Clockwork Orange on your ass.
Are we not friends now?
No, I didn't say we weren't friends, but I said that there's an intervention necessary of a Clockwork Orange variety, where we go and prop your eyelids open, and you get drops put in your eyes while you're watching Game of Thrones, and I can't shut me glasses.
That's what it would take. But yeah, so no, you're allowed to not like somebody.
Yes, I'm teasing. I just bring it up because it is a bone of contention with people.
Is it specifically like the genre? Do you like Boris at all, or?
It isn't even just a genre so much. I think one of the things that bothers me most, and full disclosure here, when I went to Ohio University for the first time, and I was taking my, foundation drawing courses, I would get into vicious fights with the debates, not vicious fights, vicious debates with the instructor of one of my foundation drawing courses, defending Frazetta and why, he was important and all that. So it's not as if I don't recognize, some of the greatness. And there are works by Frazetta that, absolutely knock my socks off. But I think one of the things I chafe at most is the canonization of Frazetta that has happened and has in large part happened because he was his own best self-promoter, and it was a little tacky, I think.
Well, I think his wife was. I think the Empire, from the documentary that I saw, I met his son because they don't live far from here. A lot of the credit apparently goes to his wife.
Yes, yes. She was a huge promoter and all that stuff, but the reason she was a huge promoter, and you'll see interviews with Frank, or read interviews with Frank when he was alive, saying, how brilliant he was. And I just, it turned me off, and again, this is also a lesson in subjectivity, going back to the Sea Hag from high school. Subjectively, it made it harder for me to consume his stuff with the same thrill that I would have if I had not been at all aware of him as a person. Some of that is true also of, you've brought up one, I brought up another. Gustav Klimt and Pablo Picasso. Horrifyingly horrible human beings. But geniuses of art.
And that's, that's a distinction that sometimes gets, really can get to people. I was just on these panels last week, and Amy Chu, we were doing a women in comics thing, and I asked, everybody on the panel what their best advice was, and Amy said that the best advice she got was to never, ever, ever get political. And I suppose that could mean political in the terms of the corporations as well. Like, never pick DC over Marvel, and never say this sucks or that sucks, but never, and to me that sounds really, I don't want to say shallow because that's not the right word, but it just feels really transparent that you're not expected to have an opinion or a belief system or anything because you're trying to have fans at the same time and you're trying to get a job. And that's, to me, that's crap.
Well, it's crap on one level. One of my dear friends on planet Earth, I've known her for nearly 10 years now, more than 10 years now. I actually know her by her real name, Molly Crabapple. Mm-hmm. She and I are very, very dear friends. She has made a career out of being political. And she's unabashed, unashamed, and she is, certifiably genius level smart. So she is fully aware that, okay, I'm, staking my claim right here. I'm drawing a line in the sand. This is what is acceptable and what is not. Anyone who crosses the unacceptable line, I have no time for this nonsense and this is utter shit and I will not tolerate shit in my life. And she puts her money where her mouth is. She's just coming back now from a trip to Mexico City. She, managed to go and get herself put in jail for a time surrounding the Occupy stuff.
Yeah, I read that on Twitter, and it wasn't like Warren Ellis was suddenly like...
Mm-hmm. Free Molly Crabapple was the hashtag, and everybody jumped in on it. William Gibson, William fucking Necromancer Gibson, Neuromancer Gibson actually chimed in on it. I mean, you know, she's made an enormous impact, and based on her example, I would modify Amy's exhortation thusly. Don't get political if you want to be successful. There is merit and truth to that, and that actually paraphrases something the late, great, godfather of us all, Joe Kubert, said to one of his boys. He said, when giving advice about working in the industry, he said, "It is a small industry. Keep your mouth shut."
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's kind of exactly, you know, what Amy's point was. And it's one of those things where, you know, I like to get to know people.
That's yes.
How I am. So it's one of those things where one of the writers that I had on the show a couple months ago, it was like right after the 18th shooting in the United States in like, you know, a month or something. It was just, you know, the mass shootings that we've had are outrageous. So, you know, everybody's coming down on the entertainment industry and it's all our fault. And, you know, you people, you know, make these video games and you make these movies. And so, you know, this is somebody who writes novels that are like hellaciously brutal. I mean, just violent. Nobody fares well in his books. So, you know, he's like, "I don't want to get political on your show." I'm like, "Okay, I get that. I get that you don't want to be political. I just want to know, like, you know, how does that make you feel, like, as a person? Like, do you drop your kids off at school and are people yelling at you for, oh, you goddamn right or you? Like, look what..." And he's just like, "Oh, no, nobody's like that." I'm like, "Thank you. That's, you know, that's why I'm not, you know..." If somebody wants to, you know, then espouse their gun views, then that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Well... Yes, and while I would qualify it by saying not everybody, I would say that, you know, a very vocal minority of fringe believers were getting loud and vocal about the it's pop culture, it's entertainment, it's blah 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 blah, it's video games, it's all of this, it's all of that. The I still believe that's a minority opinion. But to finish the modification of Amy's exhortation, you know, Joe's wisdom being what it was, is good for the vast majority of people. But Molly's example, ties into it thusly. If you aren't going to keep your mouth shut and you are going to have very, very strong outward opinions, make sure that they inform your work. Make sure that that is the type of work that you are going to commit to doing, and that you are going to always tell the truth of your belief and your conviction. Keep your mouth shut from the sense that, you know, you don't want to go and start gossiping, you know, "Oh my gosh, you know, I saw this one with that one, and oh my gosh, they were canoodling, and oh, they went to the same hotel room at a convention." No, that, you know, that's a recipe for disaster in anything. But from a standpoint like Molly's, if you're going to have a very firm belief that, the world is being systematically taken apart financially by, nefarious corporate interests and, people who are, greedily.
The man.
Yeah. If the Illuminati type concept, if corporations are going to continue to savage, the mass populace for their own, financial gain, you better believe it and you better tell the truth of it and you'd better, make sure that you have the courage of that conviction and all that comes with it. Not getting certain jobs because, your flavor doesn't fit this type of job, that kind of thing. Me, I'm more of a middle of the road type guy. I found that essay that I sent you on Kindle, that Stephen King essay.
Right. Which I read through, and I don't read his literature, but I love his just his personality and everything about him and his nonfiction type stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, he didn't sway me at all. I still have issue with what happened, but I respect him as a human being and I respect him as an artist.
And that's all the vast majority of that was. I mean, he was a sleep easy at night owner of three pistols by his own admission. And his, his thesis hinged on, a part in the middle where he says, and it's funny that it showed up in the middle. He said, the vast majority of compromise can be found in the middle because there's a lot of cheap real estate there, brothers and sisters. Well, I happen to occupy a lot of that cheap real estate. I believe in very responsible, reasonable measures on that topic and several other topics that are very, very, very important to, a functioning republic that's, that has this the place that the United States does within the world. So, because I occupy the middle and I'm not fervently zealous about either side on most topics.
Except Game of Thrones, apparently.
My heart is broken. My heart is broken. I'm also given to verbal as well as visual hyperbole, you'll find out. Because I occupy the middle, it's best for me and the types of work that I do to keep my mouth shut politically because, me saying, I understand both sides of this debate fairly well, is not a real interesting political stance and a political belief. So telling the truth of that is, milquetoast. So keep your mouth shut if you want to get certain types of work that fall into the vast majority is, I think, a qualification that belongs on that point.
And before I let you go, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, everything hinged on how much time we had and you weren't sure if, you were going to be interesting enough to talk to you. And obviously I could keep talking to you for another hour.
That's what editing's for.
So, yeah, but see, I have to do everything here. I am the producer. I am the booking agent. I am the programmer.
And the talent.
And the on-air talent. So
there you go. And you do a fabulous job, quite obviously.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So, yeah, so there's not much editing done. There's some. But here over, on the East Coast, we got hit by the Superstorm Sandy.
Mm.
And, and of course that gets all political too. And then the conspiracy theorists came out. And, I mean, there's just so much. It doesn't take long for things to go insane. But one of the people that I personally know who was literally devastated was a comic book artist, J.K. Woodward. And there were people, everybody who knows him and, you know, saw the tweets going out. So many people sent him and his family things to just help them get by because they lost everything. Everything. I mean, they saved their cat and a six pack or something like that. It was one of those things like they had nothing left. And so when I was flipping through the art news today, I saw that there's an art exhibit in Manhattan, which actually features like remnants from all different disasters. And it's not really the same as like a museum of when somebody finds a shipwreck and they haul it up and they put it in the Smithsonian. That's kind of like, to me, that's sort of a different feeling. But this was like finding bits and pieces of wreckage and things that have been painted and rewelded and reformed, you know, like turned into art from the wreckage. And so there's ones from tornadoes and the wildfires in California. And now they have added some Superstorm Sandy displays.
Ooh.
And it's in Manhattan called the Chashma Gallery, I think is how you pronounce it, in the Chelsea neighborhood. So there actually was like a few slides on, if you just, you know, Google up, it's called After Effects. And you could probably find some slides from the actual pieces that are on exhibit. And there, I mean, I didn't see anything disrespectful or lacking in any kind of taste. So, but I know that it doesn't take much to upset people. And I didn't know if it's just a way to capitalize on tragedy or if it's a way of coping with tragedy. Because from an art perspective, I know, like when 9/11 happened, how the artists all came together and they didn't know how else to express things except through art, you know, whether it was song or through paintings or through comics. It's just what they did. So, you know, of course, Superstorm Sandy, we had all sorts of concerts, and that sort of doesn't feel the same as like somebody coping. That's more like, okay, we're going to just help you raise money. you know, it's not like the song about the sinking of the Fitzgerald.
The wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
One of my favorite songs.
Sorry, my younger listeners, you won't know what that is. Go find it on iTunes.
And please do, because that is a very, very worthwhile song to have.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you ever think that there's issue with tragedy like this being just art being turned into commercial gain?
No. I because I am nothing if not a very mercenary minded. I've got a mortgage. I've got a family. I still have student loans at this advanced stage, believe it or not. I believe very, very, very firmly that whether you want to call it a $400,000 Hockney original, or you want to call it a $4,000 painting that gets reproduced 100,000 times at a buck a pop, I don't care. Do whatever it is that will support your family, all of that sort of stuff. I think it's my observation that a lot of that politicized notion of capitalizing on tragedy to make money still stems from that high versus low art divide. Art for art's sake is a wonderful thing, but not everyone is going to go and live Van Gogh's life and, be that miserable. The only shame I personally see in situations like that is if the artists aren't participants, both in the selection as well as the making of the art and the proceeds from it. You know, people who've, you know, lost everything and then their pieces are cobbled back together, and that turns into a you know, a platform where people can go and you know, have a keepsake of an event of that sort, you know, for whatever their reasons, be it morbid curiosity, be it a matter of wanting to be charitable, whatever their, you know, whatever the impetus, it doesn't matter so long as the artists who are affected still participate in that remuneration. That's I think is key. Long-winded way of saying, as long as artists aren't being ripped off, and as long as they participate, do whatever it is that keeps the lights on.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty valuable lesson, and I know that there's a lot of debate about you know, doing work for free, but you know, that happens. And for some reason, I think that artists almost feel like it only happens to them. Like there's, I don't know why they think that's in their head, but I'll tell you what, as somebody who used to be married to like an IT tech guy, he got, you know, calls all the time, come fix my computer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, family, friends, everything, you know, so it's not that it's just an art thing where people appreciate when you, you know, do something for them for free. As long as they're appreciative, I think it's, you know, you just can't, you can't obviously get taken advantage of, and like you said, you need to be able to pay your bills.
Mm-hmm.
So those are definitely key things. But I mean, there is such a thing as charity, and there's such a thing,
yes,
as being a nice, decent human being and being good to your friends and your family.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of, it was just kind of interesting that all this came up, like, you know, at the same time.
Hmm.
Reading all these different debates and whatnot. But so yeah, if you're in the New York City area and you want to go see it again, it's called After Effects. Rich, give us some idea of what projects you're working on and where we can find you, like conventions and stuff. But I know that you're like completely busy, so I want to know what projects you're on.
Oh, I'm on all sorts of good stuff. And one of them, finally get to thank you sort of in person for helping get us over the hump, as it were, working on Deluge with your friend of mine, J.D. Oliva.
Beautiful book and amazing story.
It's an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to be working on it. I wish to goodness that my schedule wasn't as overbooked as it is, because it would be really cool to focus solely on it. But, you know, it still is independent comics, and you know, a couple of gigs have come up in between. So I am still very, very diligently working on that. And that should be out as soon as it humanly can be out. First two of three are in the can. And I am feverishly working on number three while I am working on a book called House of Gold and Bones.
That sounds very cool.
It is very cool. The path I took to getting this book is a bit long and convoluted. But Dark Horse, to shorten it enormously, Dark Horse is someone with which I've been doing some work recently. A couple of gigs on Creepy. A couple of years ago, I worked with Derek Robertson on the Vork one shot. Mm-hmm, from the Guild.
Yes.
Yep. Got to meet Felicia Day at the convention after that book came out, and she is as cool a human being in real life as she is in all of her media appearances. She's just one of those singular gems of a human that makes you believe that good people do get successful.
Yeah, she works her butt off for it.
But because I had a few projects in with Dark Horse, this opportunity for House of Golden Bones came up. And what that is, Corey Taylor, who fronts the bands Slipknot and Stone Sour, wrote a short story that turned into a double concept album for his with his band Stone Sour. And since he had the short story and his band was putting together this concept album, he thought, you know, he, like me, had gotten away from comics for a while and then was brought back in by some material that spoke, you know, directly to him. And he said, man, this would be a really, really cool limited series. And long circuitous route, he went and landed at Dark Horse with his project. And I just happened to be, one of 10 artists, as it turns out, that Dark Horse presented to Corey. I got the gig. I was picked out of everybody else to do this gig. And now I'm furiously working on issue 2.
Insane. That is awesome news.
Yeah, it's Comic Book Resources has a really, really cool article on it. If anything, when we finish our chit chat here, I will email you over the link, and maybe you could put it in the notes for the podcast when it goes up. But it drops in April. Issue number 1 should drop in April, the middle of April. I think the 17th is its on sale date. If all goes according to schedule, almost the entire 4 issues should be in the can right around the time issue number 1 drops. So there will be no delays. Fans of Corey Taylor's and his band's work will dig this enormously. It's a pretty direct tie-in to the narrative parts of this double concept album. The first of the 2 albums came out this past October, and it's a thrilling, terrific, terrific, terrific record. And there should be no delays. None of those first 2 issues are out, and now we're waiting 2 months for issue 3 and then 6 months for issue 4. This is going to come out regular as clockwork. Dark Horse is very, very, very committed to the project. And it's coincidental that Corey's bands will start a world tour just as issue 1 is hitting comic book shops. So we're praying for one of those big landmark type success stories with this book, because it's a fun ride. I describe an awful lot of my take on the story in that CBR article, and it's much better when you read it than when I try to reinvent it from scratch from memory.
That's okay. And you know, I mean, Dark Horse is phenomenal. I mean, they are very particular, and you know, it obviously shows in the quality of what they put out. So I have, you know, absolutely no doubt that it'll be stunning.
Well, jury's still out. Issue number 2 is still in works, so I've got my fingers crossed. We're pretty confident about number 1. The colorist is doing a terrific job, and my wish came true, and they did tap Nate Picos over at Blambot to letter the book. So, you know, the design and the lettering is going to be fantastic, first rate.
That's pretty sweet. Did you have a say in the colorist?
No. The way the book got cast was a very funny sort of intricate wayward around the bend and come back to the original place sort of process. But, you know, Corey was at the New York show in October and had actually spoken to Comic Book Resources on tape, on video, about the project. And, you know, his first choice, as it turns out, was to have Derek Robertson do breakdowns and me do finishes. And as it turns out, Derek did not have time, and he's booked like he's not taking anything else for 2013, as it turns out. He's booked through January 2014, which is a good place to be. But, you know, unqualified success after unqualified success after unqualified success. You know, he goes from Transmet, you know, the Wolverine and Nightcrawler stuff, and then goes over to the Boys, and the Boys is a seismic, landmark in the industry at the time it was coming out. And from there, he jumps onto a little book called Happy with a guy you might have also heard of, Grant Morrison.
And, yeah, he's doing pretty well for himself.
Well, you know, staying busy. You make your own luck by staying as busy as you can. And I was lucky enough to color the all four covers and the first two issues of that book. And that was a hell of a fun.
So where can you have people follow you and whatnot so that they can keep up on all of this news about that project and all of your other projects? Like, you know, you said, mentioned Deluge and...
The best place to go, the hub, the place where it all starts is Zippy Studio. That's ZIPPYStudio.com. And, excuse me, from there you can find Facebook and Twitter icons. I recommend everybody go and click on the Twitter icon and follow me on Twitter because I am a hoot.
Absolutely. Very endearing. He will endear himself to you and your hearts as well.
And I'll drop art every now and again and get very, very, very kind comments from this podcast's hostess every now and again. And it's I drop some of the figure drawing stuff. I drop some of the thumbnails, panels out of sequence, little things that keep, keep the day moving along for people who follow Twitter for that sort of stuff.
I think it's great to follow artists, especially when they're, you know, when they do things like that, when they do post, you know, because there's some people who, you know, they only talk about their order codes. like that's not an interesting way to tweet.
No, I would have to have some order codes in order to tweet that sort of stuff. And I'm not above doing, you know, a little bit of shameless self-promotion every now and again. I did tweet out the CBR article, which will show up hopefully in the notes of this. And if not, just go to comicbookresources.com and plug in House of Gold and Bones into the search, and you will get the article with some of my art, including the variant cover for number one. And
I have to link back to amberunmasked.com. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, then you should have been following me on Twitter today, because I actually sent out that link today in response to someone else who hadn't seen it. So there you are. We're going to have to go and get all of our ducks in a row.
I think so.
One other bit of news about House of Golden Bones. Jason Sean Alexander is painting the primary covers for all four books, and I've seen the first two, and holy shit.
That's a good, valid reaction.
Yeah, I think that that's going to be a lot of people's reaction. JSA certainly comes at his visual art making from the same place that that inspired me while in my late teens and all through my 20s, very much of the painter, direct painting approach to making visual art. And they're very evocative, very juicy surfaces, very, very active and furious painting. And the interiors aside, your $3 will be well spent just to go and get, at the minimum, those covers, because those things are just damned fine. And what do you know? You'll also get some bonus interior stuff to go and line your cat litter box with.
Aww.
I'm being facetious. I'm working my ass off on this, and everybody had better love it.
I'm, you know, and I'm a person who loves the trades as well. So when you find out any information, like if there's extra stuff in the trade, be sure to let me know. Because I don't know how far ahead they plan that kind of thing.
I don't know yet either. I would venture a guess that this will be collected. Everything Dark Horse does is collected at some point shortly after completion. And I'm hoping that there's going to be a trade, because I am going to lobby furiously to get the assignment of painting a wraparound cover for that trade. Mwahahaha.
Well, I think you got a pretty good shot there.
JSA is probably going to get that, and he should, you know, as a cover artist, because, again, you know, tone-wise, flavor-wise, what he's doing fits so well with the, the sort of esoteric and, more evocative than literal nature of the story, that I think he is the perfect choice.
And hopefully then come October, we will have another Richard Clark piece in the Superhero Wonder Woman Day auction.
I hope so, too.
I hope so.
Yeah.
So that would be swell.
And hopefully, so right around the same time, you'll invite me back to Vodka O'Clock to talk about my very own Kickstarter, which should launch at some point here in 2013. Mwahahaha.
Well, definitely. Definitely. Cool. Richard, thank you all this time. This is amazing. See? And I think it was pretty painless.
Oh, it was more than, it was absolutely lovely. You're a delight to talk to. And obviously I am nothing if not a blabbermouth.
That's perfectly fine. It's easier to work with. It's totally fine.
Excellent. Well, thank you for a very, very, very good time. And I hope that all of your listeners got at least some fun out of this. And I hope that I have 100,000 Twitter followers after this hits iTunes.
That'd be swell, because even I don't have that. So we'll work on that, you guys. Follow both of us. You can follow me at Elizabeth Amber if you didn't already know. And that's, of course, where I post all of my regular nonsense. So you will get all of my banter and opinions and hateful remarks. But you also get the announcements of when new episodes of Vodka O'Clock are out.
And that's worthwhile.
Absolutely. Everything else is at amberunmasked.com, and links to all of the projects I'm working on. And, there's Facebook, but I kind of hate them. So Twitter. Twitter's the place to find me, at Elizabeth Amber. And you've been, once again, listening to me talk to Richard Clark. So be sure to look out for all of those projects soon. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Cheers.
Cheers.